Welcome back to the PigX Podcast. I'm your host, Delaney Howell. This month, we're shaking things up and bringing you something very unique, as we have two very different guests talking about different topics, but all related to the topic of swine sustainability. To start out, we'll be visiting with Jack Bobo, the Director of Global Food and Water Policy at one of the world's largest conservation organizations, the Nature Conservancy. Throughout his interview, we'll learn about his Iowa Swine Day presentation, which focused on how animal agriculture will save the planet. Later in the episode, we chat with Dan Bucieres, who is the co-founder and swine nutritionist for Group Sarah's Inc. But before we dive into learning more about Dan and his research, let's kick things off with Jack.
My name is Jack Bobo. I'm currently the Director of Global Food and Water Policy at the Nature Conservancy, one of the world's largest conservation organizations. But I also spent 13 years at the U.S. Department of State working on global food policy. And during that time, I really had an opportunity to travel around the world, visit research centers, meet with ministers and students and all sorts of people in order to get a really global perspective on the food we eat and the challenges we face.
And so the topic that you talked about at the Iowa Swine Day was focused around, can agriculture save the planet? How did you come up with that idea as a topic?
Yeah, well, often I hear people talking about the problems of agriculture, and there are a lot of challenges. Agriculture has a lot of negative impact, but there's just nothing more critical for our daily survival. And so my question is, you know, what would we have to do to change agriculture to make it, you know, even more of a force for good?
And so as you look at the investment in agriculture, you have a different way of looking at the situation that's going on. So maybe you could frame up where we're at currently as far as the sustainability piece goes and how agriculture fits into that solution for us a little bit more.
Yeah, well, so first sort of the problem, you know, 40% of all the land on Earth that could be used for agriculture is being used for agriculture today. The amount of cropland is the size of South America. The amount of pasture land is the size of Africa. So I think we would all agree the footprint of agriculture is as big, if not bigger, than we want it to be. In terms of water, 70% of all fresh water goes to agriculture. The Colorado River, the fifth largest river in America, no longer flows to the sea. I mean, these are huge challenges that we're facing. Greenhouse gas emissions, 10 to 15% from agriculture, another 10 to 15% from deforestation. That's a huge impact. And yet, you know, we spend a lot of time talking about energy policy, but for every dollar you invest in agriculture, you get $1.43 back. You know, everywhere in the world, there are these positive rates of return. And for me, that's a very hopeful message. The more we invest in agriculture, the more of a return we get. Whereas when we think about fossil fuels, you know, when you invest in wind and solar, they're less efficient than fossil fuels. They're critical long-term investments for our future, but you don't get that kind of a return. And so for me, it's we want people to think about agriculture as the source of opportunity instead of the problem, you know, because really there's nothing that's impacted more by climate change and all these things in agriculture in terms of drought or flooding or all of these things. And so if it can be part of the solution, then that's a win for everyone.
So you mentioned that agriculture really can be an opportunity for some of this fixes towards greenhouse gas emissions, climate change, etc. But how do you get people excited about that?
Yeah, well, today, diet-related chronic illnesses are a trillion-dollar problem just in the United States. So the money that we invest in trying to make people healthy. So for me, just right off the bat, there's this trillion-dollar pot of money that could be directed to making our food system as good as it could be. So one, I would just love to see more investment. We see about 30 times, 20 times more investment in medical technologies and drug discovery and things compared to agriculture. So, you know, we're spending all of this money to help make people healthy instead of spending money to keep people healthy, which obviously is going to be a less expensive thing to do. And I think people would then appreciate what agriculture has been able to contribute.
Are we having these issues because the food system is broken?
Well, I hear a lot that the food system is broken. And I think part of the reason people think that is, you know, you look around and 800 million people will go to bed hungry today. And that's obviously unacceptable in the world today. You know, we want to do something to help and feed those people. But that's about 10% of all the people on the planet. But, you know, 20, 30 years ago, about 20% of all the people on the planet would have been going to bed hungry. And 50, 60 years ago, it would have been 30%. So while things are bad, in many ways, they're not bad and getting worse. They're actually good and getting better, just not fast enough. And so the fact that agriculture is so much better, we just don't see it because agriculture has to deliver more and more every year. And so all of its improvements are just sort of overwhelmed by demand.
I And I like the way that you shared it, that it's good in getting better. And, you know, you talked about food safety. You know, 100 years ago, people were concerned about food safety. Was the food that they were eating going to cause them disease, death, etc.? Now the standard has changed more to transparency as the next set of standards. How does that become the new normal?
Yeah, so at the beginning with food safety, you know, it was something that companies aspired to. If I could be safer than my competitor, then I would get more customers. Well, as food became safer, it stopped being a ceiling and it became a floor that everybody was expected to meet. Same as today with transparency, that consumers are pretty worried about, like, where does their food come from? You know, what are the ingredients? They want our food system to be more transparent. But 15, 20 years from now, they're not going to be thinking about it much at all because food will just be wildly more transparent. So it will go from being something that we aspire to and go to something that's, you know, expected. And the difference is, for businesses, if they're more transparent than the competitors today, that may be a business opportunity and they'll be rewarded by the market. On the other hand, 20 years from now, they'll only be punished for failures of transparency. And so if you're a business and you're trying to decide, do I jump in and become more transparent, make my ingredients and all of that available? The question isn't, will you do it? It's, when will you do it? Do you want to do it while you can be rewarded, or do you want to wait until you've been punished?
And the other big factor that we talk a lot about is, you know, moving towards 2050, there's going to be 9.5-10 billion people in the world. How does the story of transparency tie into that fact when, you know, there's maybe the more educated food consumers, Europe, US, etc., they understand the product, they want to pay more, they're willing to pay more for things like transparency. But then there's countries that are underserved and underdeveloped, such as some African countries, who are just trying to find where their next meal is coming from in some instances. How does that transparency story play out here as we approach that 2050 number?
It plays out in a few ways. I mean, one, in developed countries like the US and Europe, often what they're asking for in terms of transparency may not deliver the benefits they want. Like, you know, they say we want a short ingredient list. Well, that means you don't eat Indian food because it's got like 15 different spices in there. And, you know, I think that would be a loss. And so we often focus on like narrow definitions of the things that we want. Or it's only natural if, you know, my grandparents were cooking with it. But, you know, things like pesticides, you know, they're wildly safer than they were, you know, 50 years ago. And they're used at infinitely smaller dosages than they were, or application rates than they were in the past. And so natural doesn't necessarily equal good. And so we need people to understand that. But when I think about, you know, that question of transparency, it's going to move at different rates in different places. And today, most businesses in sub-Saharan Africa are not going to be adopting transparency models, but many of the same technology that's relevant for transparency is also relevant for food safety. So in other words, if I have traceability of my food supply chain, well, that allows you to know more about the safety of your product. But if you know about safety of the product and you have traceability, well, now you can identify quality. And if you can identify quality, you can begin to tell a story. And then you can be able to get a premium because of the story you tell. And so transparency will come inevitably by enhancing that traceability. They'll have it before they actually are using it.
I also found the notion that you shared that consumers have never cared more, but no less. That's such an interesting position to be in right now as people that produce food.
Yeah, I think it's tough because, you know, people really are passionate about food production, and yet most people are so far removed. When I was growing up, you know, we didn't have a farm, but the cornfield literally came to my back of our property. And, you know, we had a family garden where we were producing corn and peppers and tomatoes and watermelons and cantaloupes and strawberries. And I tell people we were subsistence farmers, and it was all organic because we had child labor, which was my brothers and me, not because of any philosophical bent. And I never considered myself a farmer because I knew what real farming looked like. But it had a pretty good sense of what went into it. Whereas, you know, today many people just have never been on a farm, or if they have, you know, it's such a narrow perspective of what agriculture is today. So I think that's unfortunate because they don't have as good an appreciation for what it takes to put the food on their table. And because of that, the things that they ask for may not deliver the benefits they want because they don't have that connection.
And because they don't have that connection, again, we go back to this 2050 number. That's a big number looming. We've been talking about it for years, if not decades at this point. But the conversation has ended there. What happens when we get to 2050? But what happens beyond that is interesting, that you're really the first person I've ever heard talk about that.
Yeah, well, first, we think of 2050 as a long way away, but 1993 was yesterday. And yet they're the same distance forest, you know, or 1995 or 96 even. So, you know, it's remarkably not that far away. But when we talk about it, you know, like we worry about population growth, adding a couple billion more people in the next, you know, 25, 30 years, that's a huge challenge. But population growth slows dramatically after 2050. And so population slows dramatically because, you know, we're just not having more children. The average global fertility rate is, you know, just above 2. So that's the replacement rate. And so what that means is that if we can get to 2050, and we can get there without cutting down our forests and draining our rivers, our lakes, and our aquifers, for the first time in human history, we won't need dramatically more food after 2050. And so all of those productivity gains, if they continue after 2050, can actually be turned around into making food production more sustainable. Every day between now and 2050, it gets harder to feed the world. Every day after 2050, it gets easier to feed the world. We just need to get there without screwing things up. And for me, this is just a wildly hopeful message because we don't have to like try harder and harder forever. There will be a day in which we have succeeded or failed. And that's why I'm so excited about the innovation and other things that are happening today, because those create the opportunity to deliver on all of that promise.
Yeah, I really appreciate the positive mindset that creates. There's a light at the end of the tunnel, but there also creates that positive recognition that there is room in this food space for alternative options such as culture meat or clean meat, as it once was called. Talk to us a little bit about that shift in mindset.
Yeah, so I think, you know, we tend to look at these new alternative protein companies as competitors. And, you know, that's not surprising because the plant-based food companies all talk about eliminating meat and that they want to drive them out of business. And so that creates some tension right there since nobody wants to lose their job. But we need to double protein production by 2050 to meet the demands of a growing population plus rising incomes. And as soon as incomes rise, the first thing people want is more animal protein. So that's why demand rises faster than population. But we're going from a $1.5 trillion protein market today, which is primarily an animal protein market, to a $2 to $3 trillion market by 2050. That means alternative proteins could grow to be a $1.5 trillion market by 2050, and we wouldn't lose a single sow or head of cattle. So, you know, that we're worried about something, and that's wildly unlikely because it will take just hundreds of billions of dollars in investment and infrastructure to be able to create these alternative protein facilities. And so we're often worried about it. On the other hand, let's say that they're successful and we get to 2050 and they've created these alternative proteins and they're supplying 100% of that growth and demand. Well, that means demand has doubled and production is flat. Well, that's a situation in which incomes rise dramatically. And so if I was a livestock producer today, I would prefer to be in a world in 2050 in which my demand is dramatically higher, but production is flat, than one where we've doubled the number of livestock on the planet and everything, you know, is a race to the bottom.
So with all that being said, I think a good way to put a bow on this conversation, given your background as also a communicator, is how do we communicate this message effectively to consumers? What are the big things we need to be talking about?
Well, I think we need to remind them that things are getting better, not worse, just not fast enough, that we need to shift some of the conversation, and because communication matters. For conservation organizations like the one I work for, we need to move from should to could. We need to stop telling people what they should do and work with them on what they could do. So changing that nature of the conversation. We need to help people to understand the opportunity that by investing more, we will get dramatically more out of it, and understand that things will get better if we do this. It's not a doom and gloom forever story. And I think that if consumers understood that, then they might be more open to some of these alternatives. We often end up fighting each other. We're trying to undermine, you know, the plant-based burger because it has so many ingredients that can't be good for you. And then the others are saying, well, you use pesticides. And we're actually making consumers more worried about the food that we eat. Consumers have never been more concerned, and our food has never been safer. You know, that's not a good world to be in. We want to get to 2050 and people have greater confidence in the food we eat. The food is delivering healthier outcomes, and, you know, our food environment is driving those positive changes.
Moving into our second highlight of this episode, we have a conversation with Dan Bucieres on the topic of the Canadian pork production system. So without further ado, let's kick it over to Dan.
Started in 1996 after graduating from Laval University in Quebec with an animal science degree. So I've been involved in the swine industry since now close to 28 years. Always been involved in swine production, nutrition research. So that's been my focus over the last 28 years. Did work for some feed company, genetic company, doing tech service research as well. But since 2004, I'm an owner and co-founder of Groupe Serres, which is a company that I started with one of my partner in late 2004, which we have been focusing on nutrition, swine production, genetic as well. We do a bit of genetic sales in Eastern Canada. We have been growing our business to cover all Canada on the feed side right now. So we have business partner all over Canada. We work really closely with a group called High Life in Manitoba, which is one of the largest swine producers in Canada. Been in charge of the research and nutrition for that group since 2005. So yeah, so my career has been developed around swine nutrition, research, production, and growing the business as well with a lot of partner all over Canada.
So Dan, I'm assuming most of our listeners are probably familiar with the Canadian pork system, but in case they're not familiar, talk to us at a really high level. What does Canada's pork production system look like compared to the United States?
So in Canada, we're about probably 20% of your size. You know, we have about 1.1, 1.2 million sow. We produce about 25, 28 million pigs a year. Production is spread out all over the country, but most of the production is within the Quebec, Ontario, and Manitoba. Those are accounting for about 80% of the production in Canada in those three provinces. Our farm size is smaller than the U.S. production system, although we do have some big farm, but we still have a fair amount of smaller farmer, independent farmer in Quebec and Ontario, and also in Western Canada. But as any swine industry, the growth has been through integration, a bigger farm. Canada has some challenge, you know, in terms of feed costs. Our grain cost is more expensive than the U.S. producer, but productivity is pretty good in Canada. And as you guys in the U.S., we have some challenge with disease, PRRS, PED. So we pretty much live in the same type of swine production reality. And Canada is about, like I said, 20, 25% of the size of the U.S. production in terms of number of pigs produced per year.
Awesome. So you said your focus really has been on the health and nutrition side, genetics, and a little bit of the production, as well as growing your business. But when you think about the future of pig farming, what do you think is the biggest data point or the biggest decision that folks are going to have to make when you think about the systems we have in the future?
Robert, the problem is that we have to listen to the market. And we are not always the one that drives the decision. Sometimes the decision comes from the other side of the on the consumer hand. So we have to adapt to those requests from the consumer and try to stay profitable. The reason my talk at the Iowa Swine Day was about research, because I think research is a very key component of moving forward in our swine industry and making sure we stay cost effective, that we can improve performance, reduce our cost of production, improve profit, but also adapt to the new reality of the industry, you know, reducing the use of antibiotics, reducing the use of zinc, changing the way we raise our pigs, you know, in terms of welfare, management, environment. All those things are important. And without doing research, it's pretty hard to move forward. So the goal of my talk was to make sure that we understand the value of research and how we can use research to make decisions in our industry to move forward.
So talk to us a little bit about some of those discussion points that you shared in your presentation about research.
One of the most important things, and I started with that, you know, as a take-home message, that the only thing worse than taking a decision based on no information is to take a decision based on wrong information. So let's say you don't do research and you make decision, you may make some wrong decision. But the worst is then when you do research and you don't do research the right way, and you take a bad decision based on your research because you didn't do it the right way or the outcome was not done as it should be. So I think when you do research, it's really important to do it the right way, to make sure you do it well, because it takes time, money. There's a labor investment also. But the value when you do research the right way is huge. If you do it right. So I think that was my main message when I started my talk. And after that, you know, when you do research, it's important to do it with, especially in the swine industry, you have research done by university that are fundamental research. They do the discovery. But in our case, when I talk about production research, what I'm doing on a daily basis, it's more the what I call applied research, you know, practical research that we do on farm. and we do it the right way, and where the outcome is easy to apply in your system. And what is important as well, when you do research, you have to do it for your own needs. You know, it doesn't mean that what you do for you will apply to somebody else. You know, there's some reality sometime in your production system that are different than somebody else in the industry. So when you do research, you know, you have to make sure you do it for your own use, your own interest, and maybe your neighbor will have to do it differently, or the outcome may be different in this case. So the level of research we do is really according to our production system, our customer base, and working with HiLife, working with a customer we have in Canada, and we try to customize our research to make sure that the outcome of those research projects, if they are positive, can be applied to our customer base or to the production system we work with. I think that's the key aspect of doing research and being cost effective of doing it. So that's a bit of my, you know, the first introduction I had in my talk. And after that, I went to how you make decision process, how you make decision about what research project you do, who should be involved. You know, it's not just about the nutrition team. It's about the production team. It's about the management. It's about the vet group as well. One thing that we need to do as well sometimes is to think outside the box. If you always try to be conservative and don't try new things or be innovative in your research program, you may miss on some good opportunity. So one thing that you need to do is listen to what other people are doing in other countries. You know, we've been in touch in our case a lot with the people in Europe because they are ahead of us in some of the practice that they have to implement since the last 10 years on use of antibiotics, reducing the use of zinc. So those people have developed programs that can help them to keep performance and be able to meet objective without having to use antibiotics or zinc. So we have to go check on those guys and apply or try to replicate what they do in your own system by doing research. So the think outside the box is, for me, is something very important. When you research, try to be innovative in your approach as well. Also, the team around you. What we do as well at HiLife that I talk in my presentation is that we use what we call a CI team, which is the continuous improvement team that HiLife has put together a couple of years ago. They hire co-op students that have an engineer background, and those people have no clue about swine production, but they come to work with us in the company, and we give them project or problem that we have, and they help us to solve those problems by putting everything on the line about what could help to solve the problem. And they work with us putting research project together, and they have no bias. The problem sometimes when you have a lot of experience, you have bias because you expect things to be one way because you think they should be that way. But when you have somebody that don't have any experience, but which is very smart and learn fast, those people can bring you somewhere else in your thinking, and you have a different approach trying to solve problem or improve performance. So having some people that may not always be have the most experience in swine production, but have some other skill in your team can help as well to drive your research program and be more effective.
Dan, when you think about doing research at a producer level, you mentioned earlier applicable research versus fundamental research. Can you explain further what each of those mean to you?
So fundamental research is more the research that is done at the high level of university or research center. That research would be meant to have discovery, you know, look at concept, new concept, discover things, but they may not always be applicable or cost effective because we don't need to think about that at that level. We just need to find if there's something that can improve the health of the pigs or the production without thinking about application or cost being cost effective. And after that, you have what I call the apply or practical research that took those fundamental concepts that may have some value and try to replicate those concepts on a larger scale on the field and making sure that you can apply those concepts and you can have a return on investment because, you know, there's things that can improve performance, but if there's no benefit at the end of the year in terms of return ROI or return on investment for the production system, it's not worth it. So that's where I'm talking about apply or practical research. This is what we do, taking some of the discovery that has been made at the fundamental level and try to bring down to the producer level at the farm level.
So when you think about doing some of that applied research at the producer level, for folks who have never done research, maybe they're collecting data, but they've never done research, how do you recommend they get started?
It's easy and complicated at the same time, because like I said, when you do true research, you have to do what I call side-by-side research. You have to compare group within the same period of time with multiple experimental units. Collecting data is one thing, but if you compare before and after, let's say you feed your pigs one way for 6 months, you change one ingredient in your diet, and you compare for the next 6 months the outcome of that change. For me, it's not research because so many things can happen during that six-month period before and after that you cannot compare side-by-side. So I think the challenge for big producer is to make sure that when you do research, you understand how it has to be done, which means you need experimental unit, you need replication, you need to be able to run statistic, And you need to allocate your pigs in a way that you have no bias when you start a research project. So with that being said, it's not that complicated if you have the right setup. As long as you have a farm with multiple pen, multiple feed bins, kale to weigh the pigs, kale to weigh the feed, and somebody that can help you to design your research project, it's feasible. But on the individual farm basis, I don't think all producers can do research, but the large company will do it. And if you are a producer by yourself, make sure you get connected with people that do research, either your feed supplier, your vet group, or your consultant, or some research group that can have access information of those groups. I think there's way you can access research even though you don't do research yourself. For sure, the large integrated company or the large feed company will do their own research. But at a smaller level, it's a bit tougher to do research on an ongoing basis.
But as far as making sure you're collecting the right data to help those bigger firms to do the research for you, what are the most important pieces that you've seen that producers want to make sure that they're tracking? And what are maybe some of the pieces that they miss or just don't realize they need to be tracking to have the best research possible?
Well, I think, you know, most of the time, if you do research in nursery and finisher pigs, you have to track the weight of the pigs. This is pretty important because growth has a big impact in terms of economics. One thing that we miss sometimes is tracking the feed, especially when you do a trial in finisher period. The feed efficiency and feed intake is a big part of our cost of production. So making sure you can track feed the right way on a per pen basis. If you do research and you have multiple pen, you may need to make sure you track the feed per pen, not per room, because you want to have smaller experimental unit. And the other challenge that we have in our industry is to track mortality. Mortality is a big thing in our industry those days. There's a lot of talk about increasing mortality in sow nursery finisher. So when you do research, tracking mortality and making sure that you can find significant difference when you run statistic, it's a bit of a challenge because you need large number of animal and replication to be able to detect significant difference in mortality. So feed, growth, mortality are the most important things for nursery finisher. And when you look at sow research, there's so many parameter that you can measure on performance, like litter size, weaning weight, conception rate, all the reproduction parameter. All those aspects are really important to keep track of when you do research in cell.
Well, that does it for another great episode here of the PigX podcast. Thank you again to both Jack and Dan for taking the time to share their research thoughts and information with all of us. If you would like to learn more about Jack and Dan's presentation or anyone else who presented at the last Iowa Swine Day, you can visit aep.iastate.edu. Thanks for tuning in, and until next time, I'm your host, Delaney Howell, and this has been the PigX Podcast.
PigX is a national podcast hosted by the Pig Livability Project partners at Iowa State University, Kansas State University, and Purdue, and supported by the Iowa Pork Industry Center. For more information on the project, head to www.piglivability.org, or to inquire directly with questions regarding the project, email ipic@iastate.edu. PigX. Ideas in the swine industry worth sharing.